Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Glazers, marketers of fine wines and spirits, and from the best chocolate in town, purveyors of fine chocolate and desserts located on Mass Ave. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. First on today's agenda is cookie baking, and we'll find out who won the WFYI and EatDrinkIndy.com cookie contest. And we'll get a little cookie baking advice from Chef Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, Chef Nicole Anke Anderson of Four Birds Bakery, and Chef A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery. We'll hear about how recipe contests have changed over the years from newspaper editor Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times. And we'll be in the kitchen with Chef Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird in Indianapolis. And we'll talk with Andrew a little bit about his Southern-inspired menu as well. And we'll also get a few ideas for Indiana wines for the holidays with Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Well, here we are. It's almost Christmas, and I haven't baked nearly enough cookies. We have no gingerbread men, no Mexican wedding cakes, not even those little no-bake wreaths made with the marshmallows and cornflakes with little red hots for holly berries. The kids did make a batch of sugar cookies, but I'm afraid they got eaten before they got frosted. Clearly, I need a little Christmas cookie inspiration. Which is why I was so excited to host the cookie contest this year with WFYI. We got a bit of a late start, but we were happy to accept 12 entries. So a dozen local bakers each brought a dozen cookies to WFYI in downtown Indianapolis. And I have to tell you, that's a lot of cookies. And we had everything from chocolate chunk varieties to peppermint versions, even a bacon-filled pinwheel. Now, the winner was a tangerine almond shortbread cookie made by Indianapolis resident Lori Goldsby. Its good looks and bright tangerine flavor wowed this year's cookie judging panel, which included WFYI's Roxana Caldwell and Don Hibschweiler, as well as local chefs Tom England of Ivy Tech, Nicole Anke Anderson of Three Birds Bakery, and A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery in Broad Ripple. After we finished judging and sampling a dozen cookies each, I asked Chef Tom England for a little cookie baking advice. Tell me what, in your opinion, makes a good holiday cookie.
Oh, a good holiday cookie has to, I don't know, the holiday tradition, right? So you've got to have something that kind of makes you think of the holidays. So some great peppermint cookies today. There's nuts, which always make me think of the holidays for some reason. But yeah, something that makes you think about the holidays.
Any tips on cookie making?
Ooh, you know, I think the most important part is that first part where it says to add the flour, the sugar, and the butter and cream it all together. So I think a lot of people just don't do that long enough, and you don't get that really creamy consistency in the bowl before they start to add the other things. And if that doesn't happen, you're not going to get a good cookie.
Now, Chef Nicole Anke Anderson also judged the contest, and she has become well-known for her cookies around Indianapolis, particularly a shagbark hickory variety that has become known locally as the cookie. Until recently, she and husband Eli Anderson operated H2O Sushi in Broad Ripple. They recently closed that to focus on their personal chef business and on Nicole's Four Birds Bakery, which now provides cookies to Lucas Oil Stadium, among many other local outlets. I asked Nicole about her favorite holiday cookie, how to make it, and her cookie-making memories.
The quintessential holiday cookie for me is called a spritz cookie, and it's something that my mother has made since I can remember. And it's called a spritz. It's an almond-flavored butter cookie. But the most important part is that it's made with a cookie gun where you load the tube with the cookie dough and you put in this really fun little die that pumps the cookie out into shape.
So now I think you said this was your mom's cookie maker thing?
Yeah, so my mom got the cookie gun in home ec in high school, and we almost killed hers, and I found another, it's like a 1950s cookie gun on eBay, and it's the best cookie gun. I would not buy any of the fancy cookie guns at Williams-Sonoma or Sur La Table. It's got to be the old school one.
Now, why does it work so well? How does it work?
So you load the tube with the dough. You pick out your die, whether it be a Christmas tree or a poinsettia or a any other. They have so many different shapes. And then you load on the gun part of it, and it kind of looks like those spackling guns. It looks like one of those. But the good thing about the old ones is that you can control the thickness of the cookies. And how much dough actually comes out of them versus the new ones. It's you're forced to have the certain size cookie, which sometimes you need the dough to be thicker, you need the cookie to be bigger, and that's what's so nice about them. And they're all metal. There's no plastic on them at all, which is how they used to do it. They were just high quality.
So it's sturdier, and it produces a better cookie, right?
100%.
So now tell me, what is what makes a classic Christmas cookie for you?
I think what makes a classic holiday cookie is that, one, it has to mean something to you. I think the story behind the cookie is the most fascinating part. Who you did it with, who taught you the memories, I think.
You bake cookies for a living, but did you grow up baking cookies?
Yes. It was waiting until the moment that I saw my mom pull out the butter to sit out overnight for these Spritz cookies. It meant everything to me, and the sprinkles and the colors of the cookies and it in the Christmas tree glowing. I don't know. I just guess I have a little magical Christmas cookie memory.
Now, you have four kids, right? Four Birds Bakery, right? Do you bake a lot with the kids?
If they're interested, the fourth baby, who has actually a lot of food allergies, is the most fascinated with baking. But I don't know what kid wouldn't be willing to put sprinkles on a giant red or green shaped, you know, Christmas cookie. They do enjoy the decorating part of it. Yeah.
And did you have any favorites from today's contest?
I think I'm gonna stick with the winner, the almond cookie, tangerine cookie. I just think it was a nice, refined, thought out cookie.
And A. Rene Trevino of Rene's Bakery in Broad Ripple shared his holiday cookie memories as well.
I guess cookie that really stands out growing up to me was we called it a thumbelina. It was like a sugar cookie rolled in like pecans, then you put your thumbprint in it. And then you filled it with like different jams or chocolate, and that was something I always looked forward to. That, and my brother did most of the cooking, or the baking. He did most of the cooking too for a long time. But yeah, this is a crazy time of year, and it's amazing the emotion, I guess, that people get when they talk about cookies, and especially if we're out of cookies, and they don't get the cookies they want. We're like right now at the bakery, it's nonstop.
Now, are there most popular cookies every year that you can anticipate are going to be like the ones people are going to want?
Always the rollout sugar cookies. Lots of calls for gingerbread men. We do a Linzer cookie, an East Coast Linzer cookie, which is two thin butter doughs, one usually, you know, with a little hole on top and then, you know, jam in the middle. We sell tons of those for a whole month of December.
That's a lot of cookies. Do you have a favorite?
I kind of eat them all, so it really doesn't matter. I taste everything, so probably right now the cappuccino cookie we do. That I tend to munch on those, and we'll have those till. You know, right before the new year, and we'll put it away till next year.
Now, what about the cookie contest? Did you have any thoughts on the winner or any of the other cookies?
Well, just sitting down, the winner, the tangerine cookie, jumped out at me. I thought it was the most refined looking cookie. It just had a nice sheen, nice gloss, and it really surprised me with the flavor. I guess if there was any criticism, maybe the crust could have been baked just a little slightly longer, but other than that, it was an excellent cookie. And overall, I think all the cookies were really good.
We've been talking with local chefs Tom England of Ivy Tech, Nicole Anke Anderson of Three Birds Bakery, and A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery. For more information on this year's WFYI and Eat Drink Indie Cookie Contest, go to eatdrinkindie.com and check out the recipes. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from the best chocolate in town, purveyors of handmade chocolates and unique desserts located on Mass Ave. Well, I think this year's WFYI and EatDrinkIndie.com cookie contest was a success, but recipe contests have definitely changed over the years as home cooks have become less focused on baking from scratch. For a little insight into those changes, we talked with longtime newspaper editor Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times. Tell me just a little bit about the recipe contests that the newspaper has run over the years.
Okay. Well, the Courier-Times in Newcastle had 40 years of recipe contests, annual contests, and it was always a really big deal. And in the earlier days, you had homemakers that were home all the time, and they did from-scratch cooking. Plus, back 40 years ago, there weren't the convenience foods there are now. But as the years went on, and in more recent years, there were fewer and fewer of the at-home cooks. Of course, there's foodies and people who have that as a hobby. But as far as accumulating a large number of home cooks who were interested in a recipe contest, that number decreased all the time. And we still had a few really strong entrants, but the number was down. And the other trend that I noticed through the years with at-home cooks is the scratch idea of scratch cooking had changed a lot. And whereas maybe in the olden days, if you were entering a cake recipe, it would be with the eggs and the cake flour and the sifting and that sort of thing. And in more recent years, it would be, okay, you start with a cake mix and you add this and you add that. So I think it's just evolved with our culture as we have more conveniences available.
So do you think that changes the validity of a recipe, or somehow changes the idea of scratch cooking?
Well, I think every family and every situation is different, and you could ask probably 5 different people and get 5 different answers. What is scratch cooking? For example, I do a recipe, and I brought an example with me, but I do a recipe that's got pasta shells, and it's got canned spaghetti sauce, it's got real spinach, cheese and cottage cheese, and sausage. Well, that's probably a pretty typical, what the typical person would say, that's a scratch recipe. But if you were a real foodie, you might say, oh no, because you need to make your spaghetti sauce, you need to make your pasta. So, you know, you need to grow your wheat to make your pasta. So it's just to what extent that you take that based on your family's needs, your time, your interest in cooking, all of those things.
Now, tell me how the recipe contests at the paper evolved. Do you still even do them?
We dropped them about 3 years ago. Last year we did sort of a modified cooking contest, and we did it for our Her magazine, which is a quarterly magazine, and we had several entrants, not anything like we did when we used to have. I've been at the paper for 25 years. One year we had more than 600 entrants in the recipe contest.
Oh my goodness. Okay, now I have to tell you, that's more than I had ever gotten at the Indianapolis Star.
Well, we're probably going back 23 or 24 years when I had that many, where maybe the last year that I ran the contest, about 3 years ago, we probably had just under 100 entrants.
It's sort of interesting that food as nostalgia. People have talked about food as like a spectator sort of thing, like we watch it on TV, but we maybe don't necessarily do it, you know. So do you think that cooking is, do you think it's becoming something like that, something nostalgic or something we just look at from afar?
I definitely think there are elements of nostalgia. Maybe it's a personality thing. Maybe all of us think back to our youth, maybe a dish that mom made that our grandma made and wish we had the recipe for, and we never thought to ask her. My mother-in-law, for example, made the most fabulous vegetable soup, beef vegetable soup. All those years, I never thought to ask her the recipe for it. I would make vegetable soup, and I realized there was something missing. So she was gone, and I called her sister and asked her, what did Mary make in that vegetable soup? Oh, it was cabbage. That was the secret ingredient, and that made all the difference in the world. So I think it is nostalgia, but it's also delicious.
Well, that's true. So all this home cooking, scratch cooking, it tastes really good. You know, so I think probably people want to do it. Do you think have we lost that some of those skills along the way?
I think we have, because so many women work. Women, there are men, maybe more men now cook than used to when homemakers were home all the time. But we do have very hectic lives. We're out there running around and hauling kids here and there and putting in 8 to 10 hour days at work. And so a lot of us do lean on those conveniences. And when we have time, we cook more from scratch.
Do you enjoy cooking? I mean, is it something you have done a lot of over the years? You have favorite recipes?
I like to cook. I can't say I love to cook. I think I like reading. A lot of women have told me this, that they like reading cookbooks, like a novel. And I enjoy that. And I always think, oh, I'm going to try this and I'm going to try that. Last week, for example, I decided to sit down and make a from scratch cake. And it had been ages since I had done that. So I like to cook. Maybe in the years to come, I'll do more of it. But I think I like reading about it maybe more.
Now, how have you seen the recipes change over the years?
They are leaning towards that semi-homemade aspect. They take elements of what you would consider maybe from-scratch cooking, gathering ingredients, but also taking pre-made things like maybe the pasta sauce or, I don't know, a mix and modifying it in some way. And I think all of the social media has a big influence on that as well. With the Pinterest, all the cool recipes on Pinterest and just the neat twists you can do with recipes. So I think a lot of us have become more semi-homemade than exclusively homemade.
We've been talking recipe contests with newspaper editor Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. Well, as someone who can definitely use a little cooking inspiration, and not just for cookies, I really enjoy hearing how chefs approach making a dish. For this week's Cook This segment, I stopped in at the kitchen of Chef Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird in Indianapolis. I had picked up some andouille sausage from Kincaid's Meat Market, and I was definitely looking forward to seeing what type of dish Andrew would come up with.
You have to tell me what you start thinking about when you think of making a dish.
For me, like, I try to think of what I want to use, like, as a base, and then just try to build flavors off of that. Try to use comparable flavors. Try to think of ways that I can try to hit all taste sensations in a dish so it feels like a rounded, complete dish.
So what are you thinking when you're thinking andouille sausage? What runs through your mind?
Well, I mean, andouille is a great, like, southern Louisiana-style sausage. Well, maybe French, obviously, but used a lot in Louisiana cuisine. So yeah, I think of a nice, like, shrimp boil or some sort of, like, andouille gumbo or something like that. So,
what are you thinking first?
I'm just trying to think of some comparable things I'll go with it. Gonna take a look at the walk-in real quick, see what we got. But I always love, like, andouille and shrimp are such one of my favorite combos. So I'm gonna thaw out some shrimp and have that with it. And we'll see you from there.
So what kind of spices are you looking at?
Oh, just seeing what we got. I gotta probably do something with little cayenne, just add a little bit more heat to it. Just really excited about this ingredient. Just trying to think, because it's kind of like, andouille is definitely like something I really enjoy using, so it's trying to, there's so many ways I can take it, so I'm just trying to trying to think.
So you've got onions and red potatoes, right?
Yep. Yeah, I'm gonna probably do like a nice little, thinking more towards like a hash maybe. So I'll do like a nice little fried potato, some kind of like a Hop and John hash maybe. Traditionally, Hop and John goes on top of rice. But I find it goes well with anything kind of starchy, like if you have it, I mean, because it is like a, it's usually like a bean mix, but if you add this, like, add a starchy element, it just kind of rounds it all out. So I try to mess around with the starches I use for it. So, here at the restaurant, we do like a Hop and John tamale. So it's like a Hop and John base, and then we mix it with, or goes on top of masa. So just like another type of like starchy flour. So I'm thinking like really nice like potato hash over the with the kind of andouille and shrimp mixed in. Be a nice kind of mix. Kind of blanch off potatoes, kind of cook them through, and then I'll get a nice cast iron hot and rip it and throw those in there to get a nice like hard crust on them. Then I'll mix in some a Hop and John mix too, which is usually onions, carrots, black eyed peas, jalapeno, a little garlic, and then I'll do a nice, like, I'll do some chopped up spinach in there, or not spinach, shrimp in there, and then probably just gonna do a nice, like, split the sausage, do like a nice grill on that to kind of lay over the top. So.
Okay, now you have to tell me what you're looking for in the walk-in.
Yeah, so grabbing some carrots, gonna grab some garlic, and what else do I gotta do? Oh, I need some celery too. And thyme. Do a nice dice on the onions. We're gonna do a nice dice on the carrot as well, or the celery and the carrot as well. And a little bit of fresh thyme. It's really nice addition. That's one of my favorite herbs is thyme. It's, I love the smell and the flavor. It's very recognizable and brings a lot to dish, I think.
So tell me what we have so far. You've been chopping vegetables, and you have potatoes on to cook. Where are we in the process?
All right, so just kind of putting all the components together. So except for the Hop and John. I like Hop and John because it's delicious, but it's really easy. Because it's, I mean, it's essentially a mirepoix with some stuff added into it. So I've cut up, diced up onions, celery, and carrots. Did a little mince on garlic and a little mince on jalapeno. Then I do some fine chopped thyme as well, which I'll add in kind of towards the end so it doesn't cook away the flavor. It's just really nice and fresh in there. Got some shrimp thawing and got my sausage, which I may grill. I'm still trying to, still playing around with that in my head, so I'm going to figure that out here in a little bit once I get going. But blanched off. Blanch up my potatoes. I'm going to go ahead and strain those off, kind of try to get them cool down really fast so they don't continue to cook. Then I should be pretty close to start putting stuff together. These are Gulf shrimp I'm cutting up. They're just whole shrimp, head and tail and deveined. I'm going to just kind of cut them in half down the middle.
So you're cutting those lengthwise down the middle.
Yes. I'm going to throw the andouille on the grill, let those grill off here real quick. Get the andouille grilling off. It's coming along nicely. Can't find my cast iron anywhere, so I'm just going to cook the potatoes on a plancha. Uh-huh. It's like a flat griddle-like surface. Gets really nice and hot. Get that going. So I'll just use a blended oil mix to cook those off, some salt and pepper. I got another pan going. I'm going to cook the shrimp off real quick, get a nice sear on those, and then I'll take those out and add my other the mirepoix mix in, and then toss in some black IPs, let those warm up through. Black IPs, we always cook from a dry bean, so just kind of soak them overnight, and then when I cook them in the morning, I put them in a pot of water with carrots, onions, celery, garlic, and thyme, and a good amount of salt.
So how are the sausages looking? Are they doing what you had in mind?
Yeah, they're looking, getting nice grill marks on there and coming along nicely, so seemed like a really nice sausage. Can't wait to taste it. Gonna go and add the shrimp to the pan here.
So now you've got the potatoes that you cooked earlier, right?
Yep. These are the potatoes we blanched off, and I'm gonna get them nice and seasoned, lay them out in the plancha flat, let them get a nice crispy sear on one side, and then flip them over and let them finish off. About part cooked. I want to take them out because I'm going to toss them back in at the very end just to kind of get them combined with everything. So don't want to be fully cooked, but just slightly cooked. But a nice sear on them.
So now what have you added into the pan?
Now on the pan that I cooked the shrimp in, I went ahead and added the mirepoix, that mix of carrots, onion, celery, jalapeno, and garlic. I add some seasoning to that as well. Once those are kind of, the onions become translucent and the carrots are soft but have still a little bit of bite to them, then I'll have my black-eyed peas in and let those warm up, and then add the thyme to finish it, and then the shrimp back in. So the sausage is about done. Just going to let those go on the grill just a little while longer. Potatoes are getting a nice brown crust on, what we wanted. Gonna add a little bit of to the mirepoix mix as well. I'm gonna add a little bit of cayenne for a little extra heat, a little Louisiana hot sauce, one of my favorite hot sauces. I think people had this like wrong idea of Louisiana spice, like they think it's supposed to be like super spicy, and I think it's more of like the subtle kind of spice. I feel like I like Louisiana because it, or Louisiana hot sauce, because it's got a kick to it, but it also has like a really nice like vinegar base to it as well, which I think is a super component. A super important component. I love a lot of acid in my food. I think it's an important flavor that a lot of people miss, so that's why I like the Louisiana hot sauce, because it adds a nice bit of vinegar kick to it, and I don't have to use like a lemon juice or something. Got a handful of the black-eyed peas. I'm gonna add those to the mirepoix now. Sausages off the grill now. I'm going to let those kind of rest for a minute, let those juices kind of soak back in so they don't just spill out when I cut them. Adding the thyme into the mirepoix now. So now just adding a touch of cayenne to the mirepoix mix. Maybe. There you go. And a little bit of the Louisiana hot sauce. Just add that little extra vinegar kick. And give it a little bit of moisture too. Give those a little toss around. Like I said, they should be pretty close to cook, so I can turn off the heat. The residual heat will let the shrimp finish. I'll start put my plate together.
What do you think about when you're plating something like this?
I just want all the components to kind of be visible. When I plate, I'm more of a rustic plating style. I appreciate like really like fancy plates and everything, but at the same time I like to have food that looks really approachable and it's a little easy to eat. You don't have to ask how to eat something, so it's the type of food I like to do. So I just think of ways that I can make it look pretty on the plate, but it doesn't doesn't necessarily, it's not all, like, the bells and whistles, like, so that's what I kind of think of.
Now tell me what you're doing.
So right now I'm cutting the sausage. I'm kind of a slight bias down through it. Just looks prettier that way. It's a little prettier way to present a sausage. So just cutting it off, cutting it up right now. Nice little micro kale from Growing Places Indy. So I'm going to add that just to add a little bit more color to it.
Now describe the whole dish.
All right. So calling it a Hop and John hash with andouille sausage. So you got red potatoes, basic Hop and John with black-eyed peas, celery, carrots, onion, jalapeno, garlic, and then a little seared shrimp on top. And then on top, a really nice local andouille sausage with some micro kale.
Well, we've been in the kitchen with Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird. We'll be talking more with Andrew about Thunderbird's Southern-inspired menu later in today's show. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible through support from Glazers, marketers of fine wines and spirits. Well, there are still a few more shopping days till Christmas, and if you're trying to shop local for the holidays, Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council has a few ideas for holiday wines. And she also updates us on the state's growing wine industry and what we can expect in 2015. So we are still thinking about Christmas and ideas and that sort of thing. So tell me a little bit about some wine ideas that would involve the whole local movement.
Well, Indiana has 80 wineries now, and so there's a local winery to almost everyone in the state, no matter where you live, something within at least an hour's or a half an hour drive. When you look at wine for Christmas and the holidays, we always encourage you to buy what you like. If you're a sweet wine drinker, embrace that and drink your sweet wine, something like an Oliver Soft Red or an Easley Reggae Red. You know, those are sweet wines that are very well known in Indiana. But if you're a dry wine drinker, we have plenty of those options as well. Chamberson is a grape that we grow a lot in Indiana. It makes a great dry red wine, a real big and bold red wine that would be a good alternative to your Zinfandels or your Merlots that you might have on your table. So we just encourage people to go to that Indiana winery, ask for those local wines, wines that are made here in Indiana, crafted right here, so you can support the local wine industry along with the local food movement.
So you can drink local, even if you're looking for wine for Christmas or the holidays or New Year's, sparkling wines. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think obviously everyone on New Year's is looking for something sparkling so we can pop that cork and pour some bubbles. And we have a lot of wineries here in Indiana that do sparkling. Easley Winery in downtown Indianapolis makes a fantastic sparkling wine that's actually made from the Traminette grape. And Traminette is our signature grape here in Indiana. So we have plenty of wineries that make something from a Traminette. Their sparkling has just a touch of sweetness. It is perfect for, not only that New Year's celebration, but any meal that you want to pair it with. It goes good with orange juice too in the morning if you want to do something like that. So a fun sparkling there. Oliver Winery, Huber Winery down in southern Indiana make some great sparkling options as well. So there's a lot of local sparkling wines that you can purchase for that celebration.
And sparklers go really well with food, right? So maybe we can talk about a little bit about some pairing ideas.
I think champagne and Indiana sparkling wine are some of the best food pairing options because they just go so well with anything. If you look at pork, if you're looking at the ham for your Christmas celebration or for New Year's, that's a great option for any type of a pork dish. If you're looking at beef, I think even a pink sparkling can really go well with a nice roast beef. Of course, on New Year's, you've got that cabbage and the black-eyed pea dishes and corned beef that everybody likes to make, and I think sparklings would go well with that. So it tends to be a very versatile wine that can pair with a lot of foods very well.
Now, what about some other wines that people might not be as familiar with? We've heard a little bit about the Traminette, and so I think people are starting to realize that is indeed Indiana's signature wine. Talk a little bit about Traminette and then some others that we probably should be looking for.
Traminette has become very popular. Back in 2009, with the help of the Department of Agriculture, we at the Purdue Wine Grape Team launched Traminette as our signature grape and signature wine in the state. With that, wineries and our vineyards are planting so much more of the grape. Wineries are selling out of it every time they put it on the shelf because there's so much recognition for the product now. And it can be made anywhere from a semi-dry to a semi-sweet. Of course, you know, I said there's a few that are making it into a sparkling. So there's a lot of options for Traminette, and just a great wine. Somebody who likes a Gewürztraminer is going to like Traminette because it's very similar to that. When we look at other grapes we grow here in the state, something like a Chamberson that I mentioned, a great dry red. It makes a fantastic rosé for those who like the pink wines. A drier rosé, it's a wonderful option for either of those. We have Vignol, that's a great white wine, typically made anywhere from dry to just a touch of sugar in it. We have things like Chardonnay. For those who like Chardonnay, the Chardonnay grape is a hybrid between a Chardonnay and a Sauvignon Blanc. So if you like the styles of those wines, you can probably guess that that Chardonnay is going to have those types of characteristics in it as well. So a lot of grapes grow here in Indiana, and we do a lot of work with all of them.
Tell me a little bit about the buying options and how you know, of course, we are hearing a lot about Sunday sales, but you can already buy wine at the wineries, right?
You can. You can't go into a liquor store and buy alcohol on a Sunday. And I spend a lot of times on the weekends encouraging people to visit those wineries when it's Sunday evening and you wish you would have that bottle of wine to go with whatever event you're having, to remind them that, you know, take the trip down the road. The wineries sell wine on Sundays. You can go in for a tasting. You can do carry out at wineries on Sundays. Of course, we have very good distribution of some of our wines around the state. So you can find Indiana wine on store shelves, maybe not as much as what I would wish. I'd love to see more shelf space dedicated to Indiana wines, but we have you know, some of the bigger wineries you can find in the Krogers and the Marshes of the world, and your CVS, you know, your local drugstores as well. So there is Indiana wine on those products. Shipping remains an issue. You can't call the winery today and have the wine shipped to you tomorrow unless you have visited the winery first and signed a shipping form where they can verify that you are indeed 21 years of age, and then you can buy the wine, and then you can go home, and when you decide you're out, and you can call and have them ship some to you.
So that might not be a bad idea to do when you're visiting a winery, you know, if you have your favorites in Indiana, to go ahead and get that done ahead of time so that you could then have it shipped later.
I encourage people, when you go to the winery, if you think you're going to want this, be sure to sign the shipping form. Or if you go to a festival or an event where there's multiple wineries, ask them for their shipping forms. A lot of them will have them ready for you. But, you know, sign a whole bunch of them while you're with 20 or so wineries. So when you get home and you taste that wine and you realize you're going to want more, you're able to get it much more easily.
Now, tell me a few things that you might be looking forward to next year. We have wine festivals coming up, that sort of thing. What do you, as a wine person, look forward to?
Well, 2015 is going to be a great year for our industry. I have a list of 20 potential wineries that could open, maybe not just in 2015, but in the next 2 or 3 years. I have about 40 more who are interested, who've shown interest at some point. So our industry could push 100 wineries here in the next couple of years. And we have such quality wineries in the state. We may not number into the thousands and thousands like some of the folks on the West Coast, but we have quality people. We have wineries that are winning major international awards and wonderful wine competitions. And so it's always fun to see the new folks come on board and see just how well that they are embraced. Of course, the Vintage Indiana Festival will be the first Saturday in June. That's June 6th. It'll be in its 16th year. We are one of the most established festivals now in the city of Indianapolis, and people just turn out for this in droves. So I love this event. Of course, I put it on, so it's a fantastic day. It's fun for people to come in and learn about the 25 or 30 wineries who come and attend and enjoy their products. So I think 2015 will be a banner year for us.
So tell me just a little bit more about the number of wineries that we do have. Those are some impressive figures. Why are people opening up so much?
We are nearly at 80 wineries. We have very little turnover in our industry. We don't tend to lose very many people. If we do, it's, you know, due to a death and somebody just can't carry it on. But we continue to see folks who want to get involved. It may be that they went to California and tried some great wine, or they visited other Indiana wineries and tried great wine and decided this is what they want to spend retirement doing. We have people that are coming out of college, and maybe they're inheriting 5 or so acres of ground from Grandpa's farm, where you can't plant row crops on 5 acres and make a living, but you can plant grapes and build a winery and make a living doing that. And, of course, demand really encourages so much growth because as we see wineries around the state selling so much product and doing so well, there is a demand for local wine, and that encourages and people to open up their winery as well.
Now, what are some of the newest wineries that we might not be aware of? You know, we know the big names, you know, that we look for and that we see in the stores. Are there some little ones we should be checking out?
A couple of our newer ones that have actually done very well in some of our competitions. Tunney Winery is in Muncie, and they've only been open 5 years, so still fairly new compared to some of our older folks. But this year in our Indy International Wine Competition, which brings in wine from 40 states and 15 countries, they won Indiana's Winningest Winery Award, beating wineries that have been around for many, many more years. And, you know, they were just floored by that. And so when we see our new wineries open and do so well, you know, people flock to them, obviously, and they want to go visit them. So Tunney is in Muncie. So if you're planning that trip to Ball State, they're a great stop. Blackhawk Winery is in Sheridan, so just a little bit north of Indianapolis. They have been open since the spring and making exceptional wine. It's a very country feel. The winery is on their home property. They've got some goats and sheep out back as well, along with their vineyard. And you really feel like you're heading out to the farm when you go and visit them. And so they're a fun stop and making really great wine. If you travel down into southern Indiana, we've got places like Quibble Hill, Mystique Winery that are in Salt Creek Winery, some smaller folks that are, you know, doing very well in the process. So we just continue to see folks open and open up all around the state and put dots on our maps.
Now, tell me just a little bit about the Indy International Wine Competition, because that is a big deal in the wine world, right?
It is. It is one of the largest wine competitions in the country. We only place second to a few that are in California. We bring in nearly 3,000 wines from all around the world. So 14 countries, nearly 40 states enter the competition, and you know we get rice wine, we get port from Portugal. I mean, we get some big name, high end, nice champagnes from France that are just fantastic. And then we have nearly half of our wineries from Indiana who will enter. When we do the competition, all the wines are judged by wine educators, wine writers, wine makers, you know, people who really know wine and who understand wine from all parts of the country, who can understand a good elderberry wine and a really good Cabernet Sauvignon. So they have to have a wide breadth of knowledge in the industry. The wines are all presented to our judges in numbered glasses. They have no idea where the wine comes from. They have no idea if it's from Kansas or Indiana or New York or France. And so, you know, and they are giving it medals. And the ones that rise to the top end up in our best of show. And then we give out some really huge trophies. And it's always fun to travel, not only in Indiana but other parts of the country, and see those trophies displayed very proudly at the wineries.
We've been talking with Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council. For more information on Indiana wines and wineries, go to indianawines.org. Boiled peanuts, fried okra, pimento cheese, collard greens, shrimp and grits. The menu at Thunderbird definitely has a southern flair. The bar, which is located in the Fountain Square neighborhood at 1127 Shelby Street, even has pickle brine fried chicken. I talked to Thunderbird chef de cuisine, Andrew Whitmoyer, about his southern fried menu and what he's cooking up for New Year's Eve.
The current menu at a base is very much a southern comfort cuisine. It's broken down into starters, mediums, and large plates. Starters are kind of, you know, your kind of like your bar snack type of thing. We wanted to have an option for people who just wanted to come in and drink, but maybe have like a bite of food here and there. So, you know, we have like boiled peanuts and fried okra and, like I said, the fried black-eyed peas. Really, the chicken livers I love. I do like a chicken fried chicken liver. We use the same flour and mix that we use for our fried chicken. And then we always do like a different kind of aioli with that every once in a while. Medium plates, you're usually good for one or two people. We got a couple salad options, the heirloom bean salad, which is really good. It's brought in a bunch of heirloom bean mix from some seed savers, and it's really good. Just paired with like a lemon goat cheese. One of my favorites on there is the Carolina barbecue slider. I love barbecue, but I hate the barbecue with like the really thick sauces and the sweet sauces, and I hate like. It's really weird, but I just hate my hands being all like gross.
They get messy and they get sticky, yeah. and then you're always having to wash up at while you're eating. Right.
So many wet naps. I know. I feel like I'm killing so many trees, and so it's when I was like, oh, I need some of barbecue, like that's so southern. But I was like, you know, I'll do Carolina barbecue, which is like a very vinegary, like watery barbecue, and it just that vinegar like soaks up in the meat, and it's so nice, like such a awesome flavor. So that was like a definite must. Then our large plates, which are 2-3, about 2-3 people can eat those. We have a pimento grilled cheese, which is really nice, house-made pimento cheese. The one that's like the piece de resistance, I guess, would be the fried chicken.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So the chicken plate, it's you get 3 pieces of chicken, you get a breast, a thigh, and a leg. It's a lot of chicken. And we pickle brine the chicken. So, the brining procedure obviously helps to keep the chicken moist when you cook it. But then we add elements of dill pickles to the brine. So garlic and dill and white vinegar, and it gives this kind of sour, pickly taste to the chicken, which is nice because the fryer flour has some cayenne and paprika in it, so you get that smoky and hot flavor in the chicken, and then we cover the chicken with a lavender and clove honey, so you get a sweet element to it. And so I was like, well, you get the sweet, the spicy, the smoky, the savory from the chicken. I'm like, what's missing? I'm like, sour component. So I kind of studied it and found these people doing pickle brines to chicken, and I was like, hey, that sounds awesome. Like, I really want to try that. And so it's, it's a steal, $18 for 3 pieces of chicken, a couple biscuits, some house-made apple butter, and coleslaw. It's a steal, but it's one of my favorites on the menu as well. We have pretty traditional sides, cornbread, mac and cheese, collard greens, which is my favorite. There was when I took this and found out we were going to do the southern covered angle, there was a few things I just wanted to have the best of in the city. It was collard greens, fried chicken, and Carolina barbecue.
Sounds like it's a wonderful menu, and the Carolina barbecue is really good. The collard greens are really good. I love collard greens. Now tell me, how do you do your collard greens?
I definitely don't do it in the traditional sense with ham hocks and everything. I just don't, it's just a time thing. It's you can really take some time cooking some collard greens. I just do a really fast. Put good braise on them. So I do some I grinder out some diced bacon, add in sliced onion and garlic to the mix, with those cooked down, and then I just start adding in handfuls of collards while they start to initially wilt. Then I add in really good amount of apple cider vinegar and a really good amount of chicken stock, and just kind of let those finish cooking. And then you just gotta generous salt and pepper too, and then you just got to pull them right when they still have a really vibrant green color, but also have and then they also should have just a slight amount of toothiness to them. When you bite into them, you should feel your teeth sinking into them. It shouldn't be mushy at all, which I think
so often they're mushy.
Yeah, I think they're way overcooked, way too much, and the vinegar aspect too is so important. The vinegar is essential to the cooking process. It adds that vinegar sour flavor to it, but also kind of helps to break the greens down, but not so fast that it just becomes mush. If you did a
if you did just like a straight chicken stock or something like that in there. So it's, I mean, that's one, that's definitely like one of the menu items where I've had many like Southern people come in and be like, I was like raised on collard greens and nobody cooked collard greens like this. So it's one of those like pride things for me where I'm like, hey, like at least like, you know, if somebody ever does like best collard greens in Indy, like I feel like we would have a good running on it.
Absolutely. So tell me about the New Year's Eve menu.
Yeah, so the New Year's Eve menu, we're not really doing any like special like party or anything. Like, it's just gonna be kind of a regular night for us. But I kind of wanted to have like a little smaller menu, but do some fun stuff on it, and also kind of test out a couple menu items for when we do our next menu, hopefully in February when we have our first year anniversary. I got some really nice like heirloom popcorn coming in. I'm going to do a mix of like white cheddar and Louisiana hot sauce popcorn, which I'm going to like dehydrate the Louisiana hot sauce, make a powder out of it, and like toss it in the popcorn. I'm going to do a some house-made tater tots with like a pimento cheese dip. Do hush puppies, and got a scallop crudo and a lobster bisque. The lobster bisque I'm excited about because I'm going to do, like, I'm going to make a very traditional lobster bisque, but then I'll take the lobster meat, I'm going to wrap it in a chicken skin, and then deep fry the chicken skin, so you have these, like, crispy, like, lobster balls with chicken skin. The one that's really kind of cool, I think, too, is the we're gonna get some foie gras in to do like a foie gras double down. So sear off the foie first and then deep fry it in a batter, and then like in between we'll have a really nice like slice of braised pork belly with a some fig jam, and I'm gonna buy some like apple jacks and make like a foam out of it and do some like apple leather on it too. So I think it'll be a fun dish.
We've been talking with Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird in Indianapolis. For more information on the bar and its down-home menu, go to thunderbirdindy.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thanks for listening to our program today, and thanks also to our guests, Tom England of Ivy Tech Community College, Nicole Anke Anderson of Three Birds Bakery, and A. Renee Trevino of Renee's Bakery. Thanks also to Chef Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird in Indianapolis, Donna Kronk of the Newcastle Courier-Times, and Jeanette Merritt of the Indiana Wine Grape Council. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.